Hello, I'm Peter Jarrett. This is number 0466, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0466. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet TV producer and podcast host Lou Denig, who talks about the qualities of people who host daytime TV shows.
I helped start the Judge Judy show, and Judy is undeniably a great, authentic, interesting, funny, fascinating person. And you saw that when you first met her, and you saw that in her first season on TV, and you see that today in her 22nd season on TV. Some of the other people I've had the pleasure of working with are Nancy Grace, Lisa Gibbons, Governor Sarah Palin, Alan Thicke, all kinds of really interesting television personalities.
Travis Smith is the author of Superhero Ethics, 10 Comic Book Heroes, 10 Ways to Save the World, Which One Do We Need Most Now?
It's fun to pit superheroes against each other. And, you know, comic book fans, if you've seen an episode of The Big Bang Theory, everyone knows that comic book fans will always disagree with each other and with you all the time, and they've all got their favorites. And the questions like, who would win in a fight, are common ways of addressing the question is of who's best. But I wanted to ask the question, which character's more admirable? Which character would we be better off imitating or emulating if we wanted to be happier or be a better member and contributor to our community?
Douglas Evans is the CEO of Hot Dog Water.
I'm just thinking back to the grant that I was writing at the time and some of the wording that I used. I think I put that I didn't really care if I sold one bottle of hot dog water, that it was really about getting people talking about it, you know, just in its absurdity, just getting people discussing it and getting them to reflect on their own vulnerabilities to product marketing.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0466 was Peter Jarrett, author of such books as the comedy murder mystery novel Signature Walk, also his comic novel Brighton Babylon, or his short story novella The Swimming Costume. That's just some of the things that he's written. He's written so much. He's a very busy guy. He lives in Brighton, England. He's lived in Brighton, England for most of his adult life. I actually went to grade school with Peter way back in the day, which means, and it's something that frightens Peter, that I actually know how old he really is. But I digress. Thank you very much, Peter, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Two men became terrified when a train they were holding on to began speeding and left their town. One of the two men from Ohio made a bizarre phone call to 911 after realizing their plight. 20-year-old Christian Hale told police that he and 24-year-old Kevin Sloan jumped onto the moving train at around 4 a.m. They thought the train was going locally and would take them to their destination without walking. The men hung on, but were shocked to see the train going to another location. After about an hour on their wild ride, with the two of them clinging onto the side of a speeding train for dear life, Hale finally called for help. However, the dispatcher had a hard time comprehending what he was saying, what with the two guys clinging onto the side of a speeding train for dear life and all. Let's just share some of the 911 goodness now, shall we?
911, what's your emergency?
Me and my friend stepped on a train. We like, kind of jumped on it. The train was like, that was really, really, really bad, and I really don't know where we're at or where we're going.
Okay, I'm sorry. What happened?
I'm on the train, and it's going really, really fast, and I don't know where I'm going.
Okay, you're following a what? A vehicle, or?
No, I'm on a train.
You're on a train?
Yeah, and it's going really fast, and I don't know where it's going.
Okay, do you work for the company, or?
No.
Okay, what are you doing on the train?
It's better than walking, which it really is. It's scaring the shit out of me.
As you heard, the dispatcher asked Hale why they were on the train, to which Hale responded, "It's better than walking." By the way, that's just a slice of the 911 call. There's 7 minutes of audio goodness, including contacting the railroad company to try to stop the train. Turns out these two clowns were attempting to deploy the handbrakes on the car, which was causing drag on the train and could have caused a derailment, so the train had to make an emergency stop anyway. When the train stopped, the two men hopped off, and police found them a mile away, and they were arrested for trespassing. The railway company, CSX, could pursue additional charges. You know, in the future, these two pinheads should really consider getting bicycles or roller skates, because, you know, those beat walking, too. Yeah. Well, we've all heard stories of kids going through their parents' things looking for loose cash to steal. This behavior could turn an innocent young child into a petty thief. It's an assumption of responsibility. You know it's wrong, but you are prepared to assume the risk of punishment so you can buy junk food or video games or whatever kids need to steal money to buy. Usually the target of these little raids is dad's wallet or mom's purse or maybe the dresser drawers in the bedroom, but one enterprising youngster from Missouri took his pilfering to a whole new level. A homeowner called police last month to report an odd burglary. Everything in the house appeared normal, and it didn't look like anyone had broken in, except $20,000 in cash was gone from a large gun safe that the man kept in the house. An investigation revealed that someone had cut a 5-inch by 20-inch hole in the back of it. According to the court documents, the only person who might have had knowledge about the cash in the safe was the homeowner's son. When he was interviewed by police, the boy's hands were shaking, and he would not make eye contact with the detective, but a search of his room turned up nothing. It's when the detective searched the son's iPhone that some clues were discovered. A video of the front of his father's gun safe was found in the deleted items folder, and someone had used the phone to search two websites, Safe Cracking Made Stupid Easy and How to Figure Out the Keypad Lock Combination. The safe's owner allegedly told police that his son has a drug problem and owes people thousands of dollars, but so far the son has not been criminally charged. So, basically, he couldn't handle the stupid easy part of safe cracking made stupid easy. I'm sure Dad is really pissed at Junior right about now. Lucky for Junior that Dad keeps his gun locked up in a safe. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? George Burns once famously said, "Sincerity, if you can fake that, you've got it made." Of course, that was a joke he wrote, but is there any truth behind it? Lou Denig is a 4-time Emmy-nominated executive producer and studio executive. He has worked with a myriad of TV hosts, so he knows that coming across as genuine is a major component to their success. He's also the host of the podcast Games, Gab, and Gossip, TV before social media suck the life out of broadcasting. Lou joins us on the line right now from Virginia. Hi, Lou.
Hey, how are you? It's great to be with you.
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. So I know I started off with a George Burns quote, but how much truth is in that joke?
There's a ton of truth in that joke. Everyone tells you you have to be authentic. You have to bring your authentic self to every part of your life. You have to bring your authentic self to your business. If your business is authentic, it will grow. Authenticity, authenticity, authenticity. And the question is, what does that really mean? I mean, really, what is your authentic self? Does that mean you have to talk about every aspect of every part of your personality? And what if your authentic self kind of sucks? What do you do then if you want to be an entertainer, if you want to be on television?
So let's talk about some of the television personalities that you've worked with. Do you know going in, and I'm sure you've worked with people of various ranges of success, do you know going in when you first meet them whether this person is going to be a success or not?
You never know if they're going to actually be a success. You know whether they have the qualities that might be interesting to an audience. I just did a little pilot, a little sizzle reel with a judge from Detroit named Judge Vonda Evans, and she's got a great personality. She has a lot to say. She's got a great backstory, and I think that she might be a talent that people will be interested in. But to answer your question, some of the talents that I worked with, I helped start the Judge Judy show, and Judy is undeniably a great, authentic, interesting, funny, fascinating person. And you saw that when you first met her, and you saw that in her first season on TV, and you see that today in her 22nd season on TV. Some of the other people I've had the pleasure of working with are Nancy Grace, Lisa Gibbons, Governor Sarah Palin, Alan Thicke, all kinds of really interesting television personalities. And they all bring kind of the same thing. They bring an authentic personality, and by that I mean they bring a personality that you come to expect from them. So they are consistent in how they present themselves, and that presentation is what you come to expect. And you look on those two aspects as their authentic personality.
But by the same token, even though you say it's their authentic personality, it can be the personality they created for the job that they have. And the reason why I bring that up, I go back to Johnny Carson. Everybody knows how successful Johnny Carson was and how great he was at his show for 30 years. But the Johnny Carson you saw on television was not Johnny. He was an introvert. He was a different person than he was on stage.
The Johnny Carson that you saw on that show was a part of Johnny Carson, but it was not all of Johnny Carson. And the part that he brought to the stage every day was the part that was entertaining to America. And that was probably 30% of his personality. The other 70% of his personality is exactly as you say. He was an introvert. He was a drummer. He loved his family. His whole existence was much quieter than delivering a monologue and talking to, you know, comics and actors and celebrities on that show every day. I wouldn't say that he invented that personality, but I would say that he took the pieces of his personality that worked as an entertainer and honed those pieces so that that's what you saw every day when you saw him on that show.
Now, the list of people you mentioned earlier that you'd work with, some of them are TV judges, some of them are TV interviewers, some of them are TV presenters. So there are different personalities involved here. Does it make a difference when it comes to the type of show that you're dealing with, how much of that personality comes across? And I'll use myself as an example. I have been in broadcasting for about 40 years. I did a 20-year open line radio show, and then I'm doing this show now for almost a decade. So 30 years of basically getting to ask people questions. How much of me does the audience really know? I can tell you very little. I always maintain that interviewers are like doctors. Not that we're as important as doctors, but doctors make the worst patients.
They totally make the worst patients. But I don't know that I wholly agree with your statement, because I think the kinds of questions that you ask, that if I listened to you for 30 years and I listened to the kinds of questions that you asked, I'd have a pretty good idea of what sparks your interest, what you're curious about, what makes you interested, and what makes you ask a follow-up. And I think that teaches me kind of a lot about who you are.
Okay, so
would you agree with that at all, or no?
yes and no, because the one thing I am is an inquisitive person. So I get to ask questions of you because I want you to shine and I want to talk to you. So it doesn't necessarily mean, and I might ask questions from the point of view as a devil's advocate, it doesn't necessarily mean that I necessarily agree with a point of view, if only to get a good conversation going. As I've mentioned, I did a radio show many, many years ago on my old radio show where I, as a black person, talked to somebody from the Klan. They didn't know they were talking to a black person.
Mm-hmm.
I just let them talk and ask questions.
And I bet you that was a fascinating and revealing interview.
It was, because he let his guard down, not knowing right. who he was talking to. And uh-huh. I figure if you've got a point of view, share your point of view.
Right.
Let the audience hear who you are.
Exactly, and let the chips fall where they may.
Exactly.
And now, I mean, as we all know, in this era of instant news and instant social media, that person's views, that person's personality can be shamed and a light shined on that, you know, globally in moments. And I think that's a real sea change in how our entertainment society works and how our society at large works, which I think is great. But you know, I think one of the things that you've hit on before is really important, is curiosity is extraordinarily important in any kind of a television personality. If you're not curious, if you don't care about the people you're talking to, if you don't care about the issues that you're talking about, nobody else is going to care.
Is your job harder these days than it was 10, 15 years ago? And the reason why I bring that up is mm-hmm. YouTube now is creating, to a certain degree, the next celebrity. And it's a mm-hmm. different situation. It's an in-your-face situation that's mm-hmm. different from the more polished style of hosts that you had worked with in the past. Does mm-hmm. that change your job because YouTube is changing the landscape?
It absolutely changes this job because it changes the expectation for the audience. And expectation is really important. If the audience expects you to have a conversation as Ted Koppel would have had 25 years ago on Nightline, where it is a long, in-depth, follow-up, filled kind of conversation, you know, that's a different kind of show than what you see on YouTube now. What you see on YouTube now is 2-3 opinions, you know, in a very short period of time, and let's move on. So, yeah, I mean, the content has the packaging around the content has changed. I don't think the content has really changed because I think people are interested in human stories, in the human condition. People are interested in what other people do, what they think, how they behave, how they've made their lives different or better. It's just a question of how do you explain and how do you illustrate those kinds of stories.
You have a fascinating job. We have just about a minute, but I want to ask.
Okay.
You also have a podcast, Games, Gab, and Gossip, TV Before Social Media Suck the Life Out of Broadcast. I love that title, by the way. Tell me about the show.
The show was really about the golden days of television syndication, the days of Donahue, Hard Copy, A Current Affair, when the national conversation actually started on television. Now the national conversation really starts in social media. But back in the day, when you watched Oprah, when you watched Donahue, Sally Jesse Raphael, even as far back as the Mike Douglas show, that's where celebrities told their stories. That's where, you know, human interest stories showed up, and that's where the Me Too conversation would have begun 20 years ago. So my podcast is interviews with the people who produced, created, and hosted those kind of shows. If you go to my website, GabesGavinGossip.com, you'll hear interviews with Larry Little, the guy that put Judge Judy on the air, Bill Carroll, who was a television guru and told stations what kind of shows to buy, how to stack them, how to promote them, Rolanda Watts, who's now a comedian and author and a host of a talk show for King World back in the day. They're fascinating conversations. I just had a conversation with Susan Winston, who produced Good Morning America in the early days of that show, and a mess of talk shows. She was fascinating. We have a new episode coming up next week with Linda Ellman and Barry Burke, who met when they produced the NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw and went on to produce Entertainment Tonight and Hard Copy and Access Hollywood. And it's just stories about how you gather those stories, how you disseminate those stories, and what the business was like 20 years ago.
Excellent. So where can one find the show? Games, Gab, and Gossip.
Thank you. You can find it on Apple Podcasts. You can find it on Stitcher. You can find it on Google Play. Or you can find it at our website, Games, Gab, and Gossip, all written out, .com.
Lou, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Peter Anthony, thank you so much for having me. You're the best.
Lou Denig, TV producer and host of the podcast Games, Gab, and Gossip, TV before social media sucked the life out of broadcasting. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0466, and you'll find links to the site for Lou's show. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about superhero ethics. Plus, we'll learn about the success of selling hot dog water. And, of course, we have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Plus, much more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, if what Jesus said in the book of Matthew was right, that it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God, and we have no evidence to show that it isn't, then there is a Michigan priest who is really out of luck. State police say they discovered $63,000 hidden above the ceiling tiles in the home of the priest who was accused of embezzling millions. The search was conducted at the Reverend Jonathan Worley's luxury home in Williamston. Police say money was in $2,000 bundles secured with cash bands that said, "For deposit only, St. Martha Parish." Worley is charged with 6 counts of embezzling $100,000 or more from St. Martha's Church in Okemos. He lived at a property worth more than $1 million. You know, I kind of like to think that this is a sort of throwback story to the good old days. You know, back to when the only thing you had to worry about being hidden away in a priest's house was cash. The Austin Fire Department in Texas responded twice in 1 week to fires caused by a spontaneous combustion of tortilla chips. Said a department spokesperson, the factory in question was trying out a new way to handle the waste from the chips that, suffice it to say, didn't work out so well. The fire was confined to the exterior of the building and to multiple pallets of food waste, but large cardboard boxes of the same waste continued to ignite while we were on the scene. The department said firefighters returned 3 days later when surviving boxes of the same food waste burst into flames. The department said the fires did not cause serious damage to the building since the food waste was being stored outside. Well, I'm just going to add this story to my long list of reasons as to why I don't eat tortilla chips.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
This is an important self-serving promotional bulletin. My book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus 2 guys who left their footprints on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So, buy the book. What are you waiting for? This has been an important self-serving promotional bulletin.
I love you. Now, back to our show.
An American tourist heading home via Austria's Vienna airport showed customs officials a souvenir from the visit, a 7.5 caliber World War II tank artillery shell she found on a hike. She asked if she could take it on her flight. As a clue to their feelings on the matter, officials evacuated the luggage terminal and called in the bomb squad. The unnamed 24-year-old woman was found guilty of negligent endangerment and fined 4,000 euros. That's about $4,700 U.S. And now, she not only can, but must go home. I'm sorry, is there a sudden dearth of common sense? I really wanted to make her the idiot of the day, but I didn't, only because we have someone later who is quite special. Stick around for that. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a man broke into a business at a strip mall in Vancouver, Washington at 4 a.m. and called 911 several times to help because he couldn't figure out how to get back out. The business? Northwest Escape Experience, which offers escape rooms to people where they can pay a fee to be locked in so they can try to figure a way out. By the time sheriff's deputies arrived, 40-year-old Rye D. Wardlow indeed had escaped, apparently by punching through a wall, and allegedly admitted that he broke into there, also a rehab facility, and the mall's electrical room because he is homeless and has no place to be. He was charged with 3 counts of burglary and jailed on $40,000 bond, which now, at least, gives him a place to be. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? What does your favorite superhero say about you? And what can fictional superheroes teach us about navigating our lives? That's a question for Concordia professor Travis Smith, whose new book covers the issue. It's called Superhero Ethics, 10 Comic Book Heroes, 10 Ways to Save the World. Which one do we need most now? Travis joins us on the line via Skype from Eastern Ontario. Hi, Travis.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me on the Stuff File.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, did you start this book actually as a teaching tool?
No, I didn't. I didn't start it as a teaching tool, but it emerges out of my pedagogy. I teach political philosophy to undergraduates, and often classrooms of 100 students. And part of my job is to teach old books that contain old arguments. And my challenge is to make them familiar and relevant. Often I have students who believe that these are obsolete, no longer have any bearing on our lives. Why should we bother? And so I'm always looking for ways to try to make the material accessible and interesting. And so I tend to pack my classes with pop culture references so that I can provide, you know, illustrative examples that do this for me. And superhero examples are some of my go-tos. It used to be the case growing up, 70s and 80s, that not everybody knew superheroes that well, except for whatever was on the Super Friends. And if you were a comic book collector, you kind of kept that to yourself. But now, well, even the cool kids know the superheroes thanks to the movies. And so they make for great examples to draw on in the classroom. And so when I wrote Superhero Ethics, the book kind of allowed me to do that for a more general audience, not just for students, and in long form.
Now, as the subtitle indicates, you have 10 comic book heroes and 10 ways to save the world. There are a lot of superheroes out there. So how did you whittle it down to the particular 10 that you used? Was it a choice of popularity of the superhero involved or an ethical question that you wanted to delve into because of said superhero?
Yeah, there were several factors that went into it. As a longtime comic book collector, I could have easily talk dozens upon dozens of heroes, but then the volume would have bordered on the encyclopedic, and also would have had too much obscurity and inside baseball, and I would have had to engage in so much exposition just to lay the groundwork for characters that readers don't know about, that then you run the risk of, if you don't know the character, you don't care, and if you do know the character, then my telling you about it comes across as pedantic and condescending or insulting. So it was hard deciding on it. I had to find characters that were well known to the general public. So I sort of made a filter of, they had to have been in recent movies by the time I had established the structure of the book. They had to have what I refer to as an ethical core that was distinctive, at least within the book. I mean, all superheroes tend to be brave, they tend to be altruistic, but they've all got their own sort of the things that matter to them most, and the characteristics and the personal qualities and traits that make them distinctive and their motivations. And that's what I was using to make my decisions on the basis of. So sometimes you'd find multiple characters, for example, who had, I chose Wolverine because he's extremely well known, right? Hugh Jackman has brought him to life in a way that all of us comic book fans thought couldn't be done before the year 2000, but it's amazing. And now women and men all over love Hugh Jackman's Wolverine. And in the Logan movie, he tells his daughter, Laura, he says, "Don't be what they made you." And so that's part of his ethical core, is that message, is that whatever other people have done to you, it's up to you to live your life and become the best person you can be on your own terms. And so other characters like Black Widow, who Scarlett Johansson has brought to life, or Captain Marvel, who Brie Larson will be bringing to life in 2019 on the big screen, and who also happens to be my personal favorite superhero, they were left out, unfortunately, not given the treatment they deserve, because Wolverine just loomed so large as so well known and so beloved that I explored him. And so I went through, went through a process to figure out how to pick the ones that fit the structure of the book, and as I said, would be well known enough and to the general reading public that they didn't feel like you had to be a comic book collector and have read 10,000 to 100,000 comic books to be able to get it.
Now, you also you ask questions and you pit certain superheroes against each other in forming the questions, right?
Right. Right. In comic books, whenever superheroes meet, they always clash and fight and test each other out. And there's always some sort of mix up before they go and turn to battle and team up against the villain together. Right. And so it's fun to pit superheroes against each other. And, you know, comic book fans, if you've seen an episode of The Big Bang Theory, everyone knows that comic book fans will always disagree with each other and with you all the time. And they've all got their favorites. And the questions like who would win in a fight, are common ways of addressing the question is of who's best. But I wanted to ask the question, which character is more admirable? Which character would we be better off imitating or emulating if we wanted to be happier or be a better member and contributor to our communities?
When you ask these questions, particularly if you ask these questions of your students, does it say something about the student?
The question, who's your favorite, probably does, doesn't it? Yeah.
But I mean, when you delve into not just who's your favorite, but what just answer, you know, delving into the questions that you put to a pair of superheroes, does the answer that you get from students or people who read your book, does that say something about them?
I think it probably does. I mean, when I was a teenager, Rogue of the X-Men was my favorite, and I'm always afraid that if I tell people that, it reveals a little too much about my own personal psychological profile. But one of the things I do in the book, try to illustrate, and in the classroom is, the internet is full of people who are very good at just expressing their personal preferences, right? Sometimes very loudly. These are the things I like. These are the things I don't like. This is what I approve of. This is what I disapprove of. And sort of sometimes in a very belligerent fashion. And because I'm teaching philosophy, I try to teach students, and then I try to exhibit in the book what it means to sort of approach something with a critical eye that isn't necessarily negative, but where you're going to try to put your own personal preferences to the side a bit and, you know, examine it generously, try to understand it on its own terms as best as you can, especially if initially you are averse, right? This is really hard for students often to do, is that, you know, to hear an idea that they disagree with and try to give it the benefit of the doubt, or try to at least understand where the person who expresses the view they dislike might be coming from without, you know, reading them as if they were a supervillain or something because they say the wrong things. And so I look at all the characters in this way. And so what I was striving to do was if I had an inclination to like a character like Green Lantern, one of my other favorites growing up, I decided to be pretty tough on him. And if there was a character that I generally didn't like so much growing up, like Batman, I went out of my way to do extra research and read classic stories that I hadn't read before to get a better appreciation of the character.
If only we had that kind of critical thinking in politics these days. One of the things I find interesting is you actually delve into these questions and you kind of whittle down, and I'm not going to give away anything about the book or the ending, but you kind of whittle it down to almost like a competition to get to the so-called winner, correct?
Right. I mean, in the comic books, there are often these kinds of battle royal type stories, right? Avengers Arena recently was a good example, where there's going to be, some victor declared. Contest of Champions was a famous example. And so I took that sort of as also part of a way of structuring the book that would grab attention and be interesting. And, you know, the question of which one is best, we specifically say in the subtitle of the book that it's, best for now under the circumstances presently. And so I wasn't trying to declare the greatest superhero of all time, all places, forever and ever, but so certain things in our political culture today were taken into account when I was weighing characters, and the decision I made in the end was surprising to me and is probably surprising to other comic book fans, but that's part of the fun. I mean, everybody always says that Batman always wins, and everybody always says that Captain America and Spider-Man are the moral centers of the Marvel Universe, and of course everybody knows that Superman is simply the superest of all. And I wanted to try to say something that was unexpected.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about the subtitle of the book, which one do we need most now? It's an interesting point because, as you say, not only are times different now, but also the way that these superheroes have been written over the years has also changed. So the superheroes themselves have changed over the years.
Yeah, that was a big challenge when I was trying to figure out the ethical core of each character. But again, given that the characters, even though they do evolve and the continuity changes and they crisscross across the mediums from film to TV and cartoons, if there's any way in which we could say that the Spider-Man of one medium and the Spider-Man of another medium, or the Spider-Man of one universe and of another universe, are still Spider-Man, then there has to be something that's the core of Spider-Man that makes us able to recognizably identify any version of the character as a good representation. I mean, before the X-Men movie came out in 2000, for a good decade or so, comic book movies were really upsetting comic book fans because they would betray the core of the character and try to be too innovative. And fans rejected and revolted against that. And ever since around 2000, comic book movies have tried to be much more have the characters be portrayed in a consistent fashion with what made them so beloved in the first place. And so I do in the book sort of mix and match aspects of characters from different versions, but I think I can do that because they have a recognizable core.
We have less than a minute, but I want to ask you this. Since you put this much work into doing this book and talking about the ethics of the superheroes involved, have you shared your theories and ideas with anyone who has an involvement with any of these characters, be it the DC world or the Marvel world or whatever?
I've been lucky enough to have email communication with a couple of creators, but only casually and only after the book was published. And so, no, I wrote this as a professor of political philosophy and not somebody in any way connected with the comic book business. I don't have any such connections. And that kind of also allowed me, I think, to have a bit of more sort of creative and analytical freedom, because I didn't feel the need to have to satisfy various interests. I was able to sort of think freely and pass judgment on the basis of the best evidence and the best arguments, and not try to appease people in the way in which I prepared and argued the book.
Well, it's a fascinating idea for a book. The book is called Superhero Ethics, 10 Comic Book Heroes, 10 Ways to Save the World. Which one do we need most now? Written by Travis Smith. Travis, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program.
No, it's been a real thrill to be on the Stuff File. Thanks so much.
Travis Smith, author of Superhero Ethics, 10 Comic Book Heroes, 10 Ways to Save the World, Which One Do We Need Most Now? You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this show, which is show number 0466, and you'll find links to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. After we announce the finalists in our wacky warning label contest, we get calls from all over the world. They all ask the same thing. Why are there so many common sense warnings on products sold in America? The answer is that anyone who sells a product here knows that they can be sued over almost anything, so these warnings are meant to prevent frivolous lawsuits. Like when a guy who was playing basketball caught his teeth in the net while dunking the ball and sued the net makers. He got $50,000. In another case, a tool maker was sued by a man who used one of their wood routers to try to fix his own teeth. The company eventually put a label on the tool warning that it's not intended to be used as a dental drill. Now let's be fair, these warnings can be hilarious, but the fact that product makers have to put them there because they're facing so many abusive lawsuits is nothing to laugh about. You can see many of these actual warnings and enter our annual contest on our website. Visit us at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about hot dog water. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Here in a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But I got a couple of Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now. According to the police report, 69-year-old Earl Gustavus Stevens had a bottle of bourbon in his passenger seat, and he was talking to an officer in slurred words on alcohol-tainted breath. Why was he talking to police? Because another customer at a Vero Beach, Florida McDonald's drive-thru said he'd driven into her bumper repeatedly. But Stevens made it clear to the police that he was not drinking while driving, just when he stopped for stop signs and traffic signals. The distinction did not save him from arrest nor from a drunk driving charge. To recap, Earl, let it be known that the charge isn't drinking while driving. It's booze, Earl, not a cell phone. It's driving while impaired, so drinking then driving. Do you see the difference, Earl? Atchison County, Kansas sheriff's deputies arrested 48-year-old Carol S. Fowler at her home in Huron on a warrant for failure to appear at a court appearance on charges of being drunk in public and resisting arrest. Fowler didn't go quietly. She began kicking, hitting, and scratching at deputies, Sheriff Jack Lurie said, and deputies had to subdue her with a taser. Two misdemeanor counts of battery on law enforcement officers was added to the arrest charges. For her mugshot, a screaming Fowler was held by her hair by a jail deputy. Days later, still in jail, Fowler still hadn't settled down. They say she bit a corrections officer's thumb so hard she broke the bone. A sheriff's deputy who came to the officer's aid was also injured. Fowler now faces new charges of felony battery on law enforcement officers. Last fall, Fowler was elected to the Huron City Council with just 2 write-in votes. Huron has about 73 residents. Well, she's a success as a politician. However, she now has more criminal charges than votes. Are any of you out there concerned with the quality of the elected officials we're getting these days? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? A Vancouver man who sold hot dog water for $38 said he did so to prove a point about the marketing of health claims. Douglas Bevins promoted himself as the CEO of Hot Dog Water and had a booth at an annual car-free event. Douglas joins us on the line right now via Skype from Vancouver. Hi, Douglas.
Hi, Peter.
So you had these hot dogs, and the hot dog water. How many did you have? And when you set up this booth, how many did you think you would sell?
We had about 30 bottles that were ready to go. And I'm just thinking back to the grant that I was writing at the time and some of the wording that I used. I think I put that I didn't really care if I sold one bottle of hot dog water, that it was really about getting people talking about it, you know, just in its absurdity, just getting people discussing it and getting them to reflect on their own vulnerabilities to product marketing.
So were you surprised at the amount that you did sell and also the reaction, the media reaction that you have since received?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I thought for sure there would be some local media coverage, but I didn't anticipate it being a worldwide talking point, that's for sure. But I think that illustrates that we're in an era of vulnerability, collective vulnerability when it comes to product manipulation. And, you know, with social media's targeted marketing and clicks and likes, and I think that just now there's a zeitgeist, and that's why it took off the way it did, is because I think what I presented was just an example of how everyone is feeling right now about products and celebrity endorsements and just like what the heck is real out there, you know, like you just never really know.
But you talk about right now, is it a situation where, because I tend to believe that the general population isn't any more gullible than it was before. It's just that we have more platforms where those gullible people can be reached. You know, I mean, I go back to a time, I'm old enough to remember when there was cigarette commercials and doctors were touting what the best brands were, and everyone bought that hook, line, and sinker to a certain degree. So what's different now than then?
Yeah, I think I beg to differ. I think it is different now. I think that that, you know, the sham artists or the snake oil salesmen of, you know, the 1920s or whatever, going from town to town. The difference is information. And I think that there's an information, we're just bombarded with information all day long, and we don't have the time to sit down and use informed, you know, decision making on it. It's sort of like you're being, it's like a million snake oil salespeople accosting you at once, as opposed to the one or two that used to be, you know, knocking on our door.
Now, if I have this straight, you boiled basically 100 organic beef hot dogs and put each one in a bottle of water. You then sold those unfiltered water bottles for $37.99, but two bottles could only cost you $75, so there's a bargain there.
Yeah, it was a Father's Day deal.
Father's Day deal. The thing that I find rather interesting is that not only did you sell several of these with a phony health claim, but mm-hmm. didn't you hear back from people who claimed that whatever it was, however it was they used it, it worked?
Yeah, well, we were rubbing the lip balm. We had different health hot dog water products. So we had breath freshener, hot dog water breath freshener, and lip balm, and we were actually massaging some of the lip balm into the crow's feet of some of the people as part of the demonstration. And they were coming back later suggesting that they actually looked younger. There was also a gentleman who rubbed it on his balding cap. And he sent me an email later, said he was pretty sure there was some growth. So you gotta question the claims that are being represented. And also the claims of the people who are have these anecdotal stories that come after.
Okay, so now that the word is out, I mean, you're getting a lot of media attention for the fact that obviously this is something that is not true. Have you heard back from any of the people who swear that it is true?
No, I haven't. The funny thing, the most recent thing that's pretty hilarious to me is that there is a cooking magazine. I can't remember what it was, but they have solicited what, you know, they did an article on hot dog water and my project a couple of weeks ago, but now they've solicited what from their foodies, like what can we actually do with hot dog water? And there's an article on what you can actually do with hot dog water, like for real, which is pretty hilarious to me.
So after all this is said and done,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure you went into this project with an idea of what might happen, what it might say about people or not say about people. Now that you've had the results that you've had, what do you think about all this?
Well, I think I've already touched on it. I mean, I think it's a general feeling that everyone is susceptible to right now, this bombardment of information and product manipulation. You know, I don't think that there is enough. I don't think there are enough checkpoints with people who are claiming things like, you know, all the raw water stuff and all the smart water and Gwyneth Paltrow's health stickers and all that stuff. Like who is checking on that stuff? Somebody needs to be. And if there was, I feel like we would feel less vulnerable, like a watchdog of sorts.
So how do we change that? Is it an easy fix, or do you think this is a long slog?
Well, I think that's where art comes in. You know, art has a way of making you think way beyond what a public service announcement can. I mean, now that it's gone viral, I think most people, not most, but many, many people have seen hot dog water, the bottle, and this hot dog floating in this hot dog water. And they have that image stamped on their brain. And I'm certain that there are thousands of people that will be going to, you know, the grocery store or to the pharmacy and looking at products and going and it'll click in their brain. Like, is this hot dog water what I'm about to buy? So I think that has been, that's where art can be way better at communicating ideas than if the government, you know, did a 2-minute or a 10-second broadcast about it, like beware of, you know, false claims or something. Like it's way more powerful if you're doing a artistic implementation of a message.
How far afield beyond Canada did you get media attention for your hot dog water?
Oh, when I said worldwide, I meant worldwide. So I've had people sending me things from all over the world, China, India, Russia, you name it.
Yeah, this could be the next Pet Rock, by the way.
Well, that's funny you said that, because I'm considering doing just that with it, is selling it as a novelty item with a message, kind of like an Adbusters sort of thing that you would put up on your fireplace mantle or something, you know, like just as a message to, you know, be aware and have people talking about it.
Now,
continue
now,
the message.
Obviously, hot dog water is not your day job. What is your day job?
I am a tour operator, so I do educational tours focusing on culture and critical thinking and science with mostly students, so youth.
And you also have a podcast, too, called Adventures in Co-Parenting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my ex and I have, we're pretty much besties these days, and we thought we should try to put together a podcast with the idea of showing that you can co-parent successfully after separation. And it's not so much a solutions-based, it's really just about hearing from everybody's stories and a place for co-parents to come together as a community and hear from child psychologists and lawyers and all of that. Just a spot for everybody that's either a co-parent or considering separation to join a community.
And people can find out more information by going to the website adventuresincoparenting.com, correct?
Yeah, and that's adventuresincoparenting.com. That's adventuresincode-parenting.com. Right. So there's the dash in between.
Okay. And people can also find out more information about Hot Dog Water at hotdogwater.ca. And what kind of information will they find there?
Well, there are the links to all of our social media, so YouTube and Facebook and Snapchat. And there's also a button where you can send in an email if you have any questions, and I'd be happy to respond. We've also been, you know, if you're interested in us doing an event, so for example, in Vancouver, Science World has requested that we do an installation as part of their critical thinking theme that they're doing. So, I mean, that's how to get a hold of me if you're interested in hot dog water related topics.
Have you heard from any hot dog companies?
No, I haven't, but that would be pretty funny.
Well, Douglas, interesting indeed. You got a lot of recognition for this. Kudos for being the CEO of Hot Dog Water. I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Yeah, Peter, thank you very much.
Douglas Bevins, the CEO of Hot Dog Water. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0466, and you'll find links to the sites of both Hot Dog Water and also to his podcast on co-parenting. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A woman in Memphis says her date stole her car so that he could take out another woman. Faith Pugh says it happened when she went to meet Kelton Griffin for dinner. Griffin didn't drive, so the pair ended up in Pugh's car. Griffin asked if she would go into a gas station to buy him a cigar. But when she got out, she says he sped off in her car. Hours later, Pugh said a friend sent her a text saying Griffin had just asked her out. The friend told Pugh where they were. Pugh showed up at a drive-in theater with police and found the pair in her car. Griffin was arrested on the spot. Okay, there are a list of names we can call Kelton Griffin besides his name. This miscreant is a heartless cad, a lousy Lothario, a clumsy Casanova, and basically an all-around poor playa. But for the purposes of this program, one has to ask, why, oh why, would you ask a woman out on a date, then steal her car to take another woman out on a date, when the second woman is someone the first woman knows? One reason, and one reason only, you pig. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0466. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0466. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Evolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.